supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
President Donald Trump today followed through on his campaign promise to cut federal funds to so-called sanctuary cities, including Philadelphia. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports that it's still not clear what the impact of Trump's executive order will be.
President Trump's executive order didn't come as a surprise, but local immigrants affected by it still had strong reactions, says Peter Pedamonte of nonprofit The New Sanctuary Movement.
From what we've heard of our members, it's been a mix of really strong anger. I think also just exhaustion with the Trump administration. It's just being constant attacks.
Trump says many immigrants who stay in the U.S. illegally are a threat to national security and public safety. His order calls for cutting funds to so-called sanctuary cities, which he says are in violation of federal law. Joanna Kaye with the New Jersey Alliance for Immigrant Justice disagrees with that interpretation.
They have the right not to collaborate with ICE. The law does not require them to do that. It is an optional program. It has always been an optional collaboration. And so cities and counties are well within their right to not do that.
There is no single legal definition of what a sanctuary city is. One example is Philadelphia, which has a formal policy limiting local cooperation with federal immigration agents. Kaye says all of that gray area means it's hard to know what the executive order will actually do.
The executive order doesn't actually create anything in terms of law. It is just a directive to look for these streams of funding. So it actually has not created anything concrete legally, right? It's a symbolic gesture.
To that end, supporters of the order, like Pennsylvania U.S. Senator Pat Toomey, say it's a good first step. But in a statement, Toomey said true immigration reform must come from Congress. He says only the legislative branch has the power to withhold millions of dollars in grants to sanctuary cities in hopes of forcing them to change their policies. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney says without more information about what Trump's executive action means, his city will stick by its policy to only detain immigrants for the federal government when they have a warrant. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benshoff.
Closing arguments concluded today in the civil trial stemming from 2013's deadly Center City, Philadelphia building collapse. Details from WHYY's Aaron Moselle.
There are nearly two dozen defendants in the case, but testimony has largely focused on the role of just four individuals: building owner Richard Basciano, his right-hand man Thomas Sidmons, owner's representative Plato Marinakis, and demolition contractor Griffin Campbell. For nearly 5 hours, their lawyers told jurors that while the collapse was tragic, their clients shouldn't be blamed for it. Basciano and Sidmons say they relied on Marinakis, a man they trusted, to select a reputable demolition contractor. Marinakis says he only made the recommendation to hire Campbell. It was Basciano who actually made the decision. Plaintiff's lawyer Robert Mangaluzzi, who made the fourth and final pitch to jurors, said those arguments still make all of them financially responsible for the collapse, which killed six and injured 13 more, particularly when you consider how little experience most of them brought to the project at 22nd and Market Streets. Thomas Sidmons had never been a project manager for a demolition project. Marinakis was an architect but had never been an owner's representative on a demolition project and didn't know federal safety regulations. Campbell had only taken down a pair of burned-out row homes. Plaintiff's lawyers blamed the Salvation Army for ignoring a string of emails warning the building next to its thrift store was a public safety hazard. A jury is expected to begin its deliberations this week. Payouts could total in the millions. I'm Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
Adults talk a lot about Pennsylvania's system for funding public education, but students are rarely asked to confront and think about the wide gaps between what different districts spend and what that means for their education. Toward that end, some Philadelphia high school students recently took a peculiar field trip. Their destination wasn't a museum or an amusement park, rather, another school. It was a trip to a wealthy suburban district just outside the city to see how the other half learns. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron tagged along and offers this story.
You can find the story of Pennsylvania's education funding system carved into Hakeem Thompson's biceps. Thompson, a senior at Kensington Health Sciences Academy, is a middle linebacker on the football team. And because it can't afford its own field, the squad practices on a crooked patch of grass behind a neighboring high school.
Our field is, like, not good at all. We play on rocks and everything on our field.
Thompson lifts up his sleeves to reveal a collection of bruises and scars. And classmate Ruth Andahar's eyes grow wide.
Yo, that's it. Yo, you got something over here.
And that's all for playing on that field?
Yeah.
When I first meet Thompson and Andahar, we're barreling northwest on a school bus. Our destination is Methacton High School in suburban Montgomery County. Methacton is one of the wealthiest districts in Pennsylvania. Median income is about $100,000, and the district spends nearly $20,000 on each of its students every year, most of whom are white and Asian. Per pupil spending in Philadelphia is about $6,000 less, and the kids from Kensington, who are almost entirely black and Latino, have especially high hurdles to leap, coming from a neighborhood that has one of the city's worst crime rates. And that's the very point of this trip, to show students in one of the state's most cash-strapped school districts what it looks like to attend school in one of Pennsylvania's richest enclaves.
This town looks way bigger than ours. And their fields.
It's like a so like 10 of our schools in this.
Hey, Andrew, listen, please, one of the things you can't be here is shy today, because I don't think you're going to get a lot out of it.
When the students arrive at Methacton, they're greeted by A.J. Maida. He's a social studies teacher and the man behind this grand experiment. Maida decided this year to do a unit with his students on school funding in Pennsylvania, and there's a lot there. Because the vast majority of state aid isn't distributed based on need, the amount districts can spend on education relies heavily on the wealth of their local taxpayers. The result is a funding system that some experts consider one of the least equitable in the country.
Take notice of what our facilities look like and what money does in education. That's the goal for today, okay?
After attending a class with Methacton students in the morning, the group of Kensington students heads over to the cafeteria for lunch. And on the way, they pass a big wall of windows looking out over an artificial turf football field that Methacton installed over the summer. Hakeem Thompson beelines towards the glass, smiling and shaking his head. He doesn't say a whole lot, but his classmate, Ibrahim Abdelghani, fills the silence.
For every sport, they have their own field. We only have, like, one field for everything. So it's kind of, like, surprising how they get treated, like, different from us.
And the rest of the day goes a lot like this. The Kensington kids see something bright and shiny. The arts wing, the gymnasium, the library. Or they're told about all the things the Methacton students have that they don't. An academic help center, a school librarian, a dense catalog of courses that go way beyond the tested subjects. Some students, like Maritza Mancibo, react with awe and excitement like they're seeing something out of a movie.
In a way, it's like High School Musical. Everywhere you go, it's like something new.
Other times, though, the reactions drip with disappointment. At one point, Maida leads the students to a deck overlooking the school's pool. And down below, a class of Methacton kids are splashing about, while the Kensington kids crack jokes that sound a lot of times like laments. Hakeem Thompson points to a canoe bobbing in the water.
Forget the pool, we can't even afford the boat.
The canoe?
Meanwhile, Victoria Figueroa and Ruth Andahar talk out loud about transferring.
The whole school in general, like, it's huge. They have everything.
They do.
How do you guys feel about that?
I feel trashy. I feel deprived.
Shuffling alongside the group is James Williams, who can understand the divide between these two schools in a way very few can. He's the principal at Kensington, but his daughter attends Methacton.
I tell my daughter all the time, it is Daddy's goal to create a school that she's jealous of, that she wish she could attend the school where Daddy works.
Williams admits that's just not possible right now with the way the funding system works. It's frustrating, it's unfair, but Williams has decided he can't just throw his hands up. So he's gotten creative, and through some private partnerships, the school now boasts a new dental training lab and an incoming pharmacy tech program.
If I'm going to sit around and wait for legislators to straighten this thing out, I'll be grayer than I already am. I don't even think that's humanly possible. What else can we possibly do?
On the ride home, I find Hakeem Thompson, the middle linebacker at the back of the bus, and I ask him about that sparkling turf football field that looked like a college stadium. It was impressive, he admits, but it's made him realize something about the field he had to play on.
Like, our field is uneven. It has glass. It has rocks on it. It's really dangerous playing on that field, but we get tougher from playing on it. And, like, when you're playing on a regular field, when we getting hit, it's like nothing.
Yes, sometimes the playing fields are uneven, literally. But the story written on Hakeem Thompson's arms isn't just the story of inequality. It's the story of the kids who are working to overcome it. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
With Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Joe Biden in contention for the top office this past political season, many wonder when and from where a new generation of politicians will emerge. With that, let's hear from Shaumish Shames, assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University Camden, and author of the new book entitled Out of the Running: Why Millennials Reject Political Careers and Why It Matters. Shaumish, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you for having me.
This book is particularly timely, of course, as we speak, but it's a collation of interviews conducted over a few years. When did it start?
I began this research in 2011, and I did not only interviews, but a large-scale survey as well to see if what I was finding in the interviews also was generalizable to a larger population.
Some 800 survey respondents,
right.
50 at least 1 hour interviews, but it was a particular cohort in graduate school academia.
In particular, what I wanted to know is how did millennials who were at the institutions that are most likely to send graduates into politics feel? So those institutions, when I was in graduate school myself, the institutions around me that I could get access to students from and that were very likely to send students into politics were the Harvard Kennedy School, the Harvard Law School, and those two together send a lot of graduates into national-level politics.
So it's a pre-existing pipeline.
Right. So that was a perfect sample. But then also I went to Suffolk Law School, which when I lived in Massachusetts, that's the biggest feeder into state-level politics.
What did you find in terms of the main reasons why, in the course of doing a cost-benefit analysis, many say, the cost outweighs the benefits?
The biggest costs in the minds of students, and it's hard to generalize that everybody cared about any one thing because people had different things that they cared about. But the single thing that stood out to me most was the role of money. And there were two aspects to that. One was the actual work that you would have to do to raise the individual money for your own campaign. And a whole lot of people, reasonably, felt that that was distasteful. They felt that having to go beg for campaign money turned them off. It was not how they wanted to spend their time. They'd rather do almost anything else. But that was connected to a second, and in some ways I think more damaging, aspect to the role of money, which was that it made the whole process feel icky. And I call it in the book the ick factor because I heard that word so many times. And it wasn't so much the ickiness of, like, I have to now beg you for $1,000 for my campaign. But in addition to that individual ask problem, there was this idea that if you gave me money, then I might be indebted to you or especially to your corporation.
Another aspect of the ick factor that you touch on actually pertains to the role of media and the 24/7 scrutiny, both cable networks and social media.
Absolutely. And in this, I kind of wish I had the data now right after this campaign. I think the biggest problem that the students I was talking to were afraid of is that they wouldn't be treated like a real human being. They wouldn't be given any leeway by media, and particularly by a mainstream media that is very focused on what in political science we would call horse race coverage, who's ahead or who's behind, and particularly scandal-obsessed media. People were very worried that their, not just their own, but their children's or their friends, their partner's privacy would be invaded.
Many of the findings of your research validated perceptions that I already had. What were some of the surprises in the course of embarking on this work for you?
I actually started with a different question. It is in the book, but the question I started with is, why don't more women want to run for office? And the biggest surprise to me as I got into the data was that women were not exceptional, or at least they were not as different from men as I thought. It was a...
Ditto minorities? Or that's a different calculus?
No, actually,
calculus.
The minority men were somewhat more interested in running for office than the white men. So that was completely different than what I had thought. And maybe, you know, a factor of I was looking at a really weird elite sample. So that may or may not tell us much about young men of color. Or it may tell us that Obama had an effect on these men. But the fascinating thing is that was not shared for Black, Hispanic, and Asian women. So I did find some major gender differences. I didn't find the race differences I was looking for until they were added to gender. But the overarching big story, and that's what ends up being the bulk of this work, is not that women are different from men. It's that almost everybody in the sample did not see a whole lot of rewards to running for office in particular, or politics more generally, and instead saw high costs.
Seamus, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Seamus Shames, assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University Camden, and author of the new book entitled Out of the Running, Why Millennials Reject Political Careers and Why It Matters. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. In 1892, as the story goes, Lizzie Borden took an axe and, you know the rest. Borden has been the subject of several shows over the past few years, and now the rock musical Lizzie is on stage in Center City, Philadelphia, a production of 11th Hour Theater Company. NewsWorks Theater blogger Howard Shapiro has this review.
As folk heroines go, Lizzie Borden is a highly questionable choice. First off, there's a lot about her we don't know. Was she abused by her rich but penny-pinching dad? Possibly. Were she and her sister about to be shut out of an inheritance by her father and stepmother? Seems like it. When Lizzie was 32, did she kill them both at their Massachusetts home? She was acquitted. Whatever the truth, there's plenty of room for theatrical license. The three creators of the punk rock musical Lizzie exploit it all in a confusing attempt to give us a gal who's an example of the way women were repressed in the 19th century. Lizzie Borden's not the perfect poster child for feminism, and the raucous show Lizzie, in your face with rage at all times, isn't the best vehicle for that cause.
In the house of Borden, there's a lock on every door. In every room, a prisoner of a long, silent war. Let us take you to an August back in 1892, when all hell broke loose in the house of Borden.
That's the beginning of the show. In a minute or two, things become more angry and the decibel level rises. It's punk rock, I understand. And it's staged like a rock concert, but with fabulous 19th century and showgirl costumes by Kayla Speedy. Yet it's also a piece of theater that needs to be understood. In its heavy and fuzzy amplification, about a third of the lyrics are lost as soon as they're sung into handheld mics. You have to wonder, after a few songs, whether the cast and crew of Lizzie, who know all the lyrics top to bottom, ever considered those of us who don't when they executed the show's sound design. 11th Hour Theater Company presented a concert version of Lizzie 3 years ago, and this fully realized show is little more than a concert version on steroids. The four talented women in the cast, led by Alex Kuiper as Lizzie, put enormous energy into the disagreeable tale. They're backed by a six-piece band that's fine when it's not so loud that it also battles the vocals. Lizzie Borden herself may or may not have done the deed, but Lizzie the musical operates on overkill. The 11th Hour Theater Company production is at Christ Church Neighborhood House through January 29th. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
And finally this evening, some New Jersey residents could soon be adding extra numbers to their phone dialing. The state's Board of Public Utilities today said it's considering a request to add a new area code to the Garden State. It's estimated that the available numbers in the 609 area code will run out in the third quarter of 2018. If the request is approved, new numbers in the 609 area code would receive a new area code. Existing customers will keep their old phone numbers, but they'd have to start using 10-digit dialing systems. This would mark the first big change affecting South Jersey since 1999. That's when the 856 area code was created for southwest portions of the Garden State. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.